my approach to politics and leadership is grounded in my Christian faith. And I think that each day I'm reminded of the strength of that faith and how it helps to sustain me.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. My name is Sam Hales. I'm the editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the UK's leading Christian magazine and it sponsors this show. So if you do enjoy the interviews you're about to hear today, you are sure to love the magazine as well, where there's plenty more fantastic Christian commentary and analysis on all that God is doing in the UK church and beyond. That's Premier Christianity in print and online. Special subscription offers available just for you right now at PremierChristianity.com. But today on the show, we've got two guests for you. And first up is Sir Geoffrey Donaldson. Sir Geoffrey is Northern Ireland's longest serving MP, but he may have his biggest challenge still ahead of him. You're going to hear a little bit about that in today's interview with Sir Geoffrey, conducted by Premier's head of news, Marcus Jones. Sir Geoffrey was elected leader of the Democratic Unionist Party, or the DUP, last summer, and that followed the ousting of Arlene Foster and her successor Edwin Poots, who lasted just weeks in the role. Usually, assuming the leadership of Northern Ireland's biggest political party would also have seen Donaldson appointed First Minister. But as he sits as an MP in Westminster, he will need to take up a seat in the Northern Irish Assembly first, and such a move is thought to be just months away. And if indeed that happens, he will be working closely with old rivals Sinn Féin in a power-sharing government that will be tasked with managing the many challenges brought about by Brexit and the COVID pandemic. As you'll hear in this interview, Sir Geoffrey is not naive to the seriousness of the issues facing Northern Ireland, but he looks at them with confidence, supported by his strong Christian faith, which he says is a constant in all areas of his life, motivating him daily and pushing him towards peacemaking. Tolerance and understanding is a two-way street, though, and Donaldson is concerned about the lack of respect offered to socially conservative Christians like him. But far from letting this get him down, Donaldson seems more motivated than ever to campaign for change, even if that means going against the grain. Well, without any further ado, shall we have a listen in to Marcus Jones in conversation with Sir Geoffrey Donaldson? And Marcus started by asking Sir Geoffrey what his favourite thing is about living in Northern Ireland.
Well, I think we live in a beautiful country in Northern Ireland. I'm a great lover of the countryside. I love the Mourne Mountains where I grew up. I think that when we look all around us, we see the wonder of God's creation. And I just think the people and the place are what make Northern Ireland very special for me. I've had the privilege of representing my constituency in Northern Ireland for almost 25 years, and it's been an honour to meet so many great people here. For me, it's the beauty of the country and it's the warmth of the people. And despite the troubles that we've had, despite the political challenges that we faced, we are a remarkably resilient people.
It's been a pretty busy year for you, Geoffrey, over the past 12 months. How do you reflect on all that's happened?
Yes, it has indeed. I guess this time last year, I didn't anticipate that I would be the leader of the Democratic Unionist Party, the largest party in Northern Ireland. But here I am, and I've been in this role now since the beginning of July. It is a challenging position to hold, not least at the moment with all of the political issues that we have to grapple with as we recover from the pandemic and in terms of our health service and the economy. Post-Brexit, we're having to deal with the Northern Ireland Protocol. But, you know, my approach to politics and leadership is grounded in my Christian faith. And I think that each day I'm reminded of the strength of that faith and how it helps to sustain me in the challenges and decisions that I face on a daily basis. When I was in the Boys' Brigade growing up as a child in Northern Ireland, there was a hymn that the BB used to sing, which is "Will Your Anchor Hold in the Storms of Life?" And the words of that hymn have often been brought back to me in the last few months as I've undertaken the challenges of leadership, but also explored the opportunities that leadership brings with it to engage with people and to try and make a difference for people and in their lives. And I think when you consider how far we've come in Northern Ireland since those dark and troubled days that I grew up in, I think that politics is the art of the possible. So I'm hoping that I can contribute through my leadership of the party to making more things possible in Northern Ireland, to making Northern Ireland a better place for all of its citizens.
What would have Geoffrey in Boys Brigade made of the suggestion that he would one day become leader of the DUP and quite possibly First Minister?
I think disbelief probably would have been the answer there. I grew up in a very humble background. I'm the oldest of eight children, grew up in the Mourne area of Northern Ireland and, almost as far removed from Stormont and Westminster as you can be. And yet, almost 25 years ago, I took my seat in the House of Commons. It's been a remarkable journey for me. And as I've said, my faith has been a very important part of that journey. And I regard my role in politics and my role in leadership as my calling to serve. And it so happens, as a Christian, that I serve in the world of politics. And I believe that some of us are called to serve in politics. And I remember in my early days as a Christian, reading the remarkable story of Joseph and how he, through a very circuitous journey, eventually became the Prime Minister of Egypt. And the purpose for his role as Prime Minister was because God had a plan for his people. And he was able to use Joseph in that position to help his people. And I hope that if my journey takes me to be the First Minister of Northern Ireland, that I can do things that help my people as well. And by my people, I mean the people of Northern Ireland.
You've spoken there about your personal faith. How does that practically affect your work today then? So obviously you've talked about how it kind of leads you, but what does that look like on a day-to-day basis as you go about your very busy and hectic life in meetings and leading the party and what could be the country moving forward?
Well, I hope that in living out my Christian faith, that I treat people with respect, that I listen to and respect the opinions and the views of others, that I have a motivation and a desire to help people, to meet them at their point of need. And that is very much at the heart of my politics, is being able to do things that can transform the lives of others, that can bring about change. It's also about giving people a second chance. It's about recognizing that sometimes in life we have to forgive others for what they do to us, and also promoting a spirit of reconciliation, that as Jesus taught us, we are to be people of peace. Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." So I think my Christian faith influences me at many levels, and means that I hope I treat people with respect, that whilst I may have a different political perspective from someone else, I can earn their respect as well.
If we look at politics more broadly in Northern Ireland, but I guess across the UK, there's been, I guess, some significant developments in recent years, which you and your party have spoken out against, things like abortion and gay marriage. How do you feel about that idea of traditional church teaching, biblical teaching being eroded, not just in Northern Ireland, but I guess in the UK as a whole?
Well, there is no doubt that the changes in society in recent years have been very challenging for people of faith. And it's not just Christians. It's people from a Jewish background, from a Muslim background. I've met with and engaged with many people from a faith perspective who are concerned about the changes that have taken place in society. And yet I think what we want is a society where the views of people who hold a faith-based perspective are respected. And sometimes that doesn't happen. I hear often that other people, others who take a different view from those who come at social issues from a faith-based perspective, they show little respect for the views of the church, for the views of believers. And I think that if we want to talk about a tolerant and inclusive society, there has to be room for people of faith. There has to be room for the church to express its view and to do so freely. I think freedom of religion or belief is a fundamental building block of our nation. And it concerns me at times that perhaps the church feels under pressure to comply. It feels under pressure not to be salt and light in our society. And I think it is important that people who approach social issues from a faith-based perspective are given respect for their viewpoint, and that that viewpoint is recognised as a valid contribution to the ongoing debate within society about how we deal with these issues. On an issue like abortion, it grieves me that increasingly the norm is not to respect the life of an unborn child. And I happen to believe passionately in the right to life. And I think there has to be space for that view in society, and that those of us who are of a pro-life perspective should have our voice heard, albeit that the debate should be respectful of the views of others. But I think that protecting the life of the unborn child in particular continues to be something that is important for me as a politician, who happens to have a faith that is important to me.
And the church as an institution, Geoffrey, over the years in Northern Ireland has had some influence. Do you get the sense that that's being eroded in recent years?
I think there are two things at play. First of all, I think at times when I speak to church leaders, they almost feel a reticence about speaking out at times in the public square, because very often they are subject to harsh criticism, including by elements of the liberal establishment and media. And I think increasingly church leaders do find it difficult to speak out in public and to give a faith-based perspective on social issues. And secondly, I do think that the influence of the church has diminished as a result. And whilst the church remains strong in and of itself, I think that increasingly in many parts of the United Kingdom, we are seeing the church in retreat from the public square, perhaps reticent about engaging in public debate on these issues. And that makes it even more important for people of a faith-based perspective, including Christians, to become involved in politics and to support those of us who are engaged in politics, because in the end, I believe that prayer is a very powerful thing. I think prayer is probably the most important thing that the church has available to it. And I often encourage Christians to intercede in prayer on these issues and to give prayerful support to those of us who are involved as Christians in the political process. And I think the church has a continuing role to pray for those in authority over us. And indeed, the Bible commands us to do this.
I want to come back to prayer in just a moment. But we're in, I guess, a pretty momentous time for Northern Ireland at the moment. Coming out of the pandemic, obviously, we've got the repercussions of Brexit. We've got the potential for a new government. What would you say are your kind of hopes for Northern Ireland in the coming months and years?
Well, sometimes I describe the political challenges in front of us as being like mountains to climb. But the thing that encourages me greatly when I look at the history of Northern Ireland, and this year we're celebrating our centenary. Northern Ireland has been in existence for the past 100 years. following the partition of the island when the Irish Free State, now the Republic of Ireland, left the United Kingdom. And when I think of the journey we've been on in Northern Ireland, I think the mountains we've already climbed are higher than the ones in front of us. And the peace process in particular has seen this place transformed for the better. And so my approach to all of this is one of hope. I am hopeful for the future of Northern Ireland. Yes, we have big challenges in front of us, not least in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol, recovering from COVID, as with the rest of the country, getting our economy into shape. Our health service needs a lot of attention and support and funding, same with our education system. But I think we're in a better place than we were during the 30 dark years of what we call the Troubles in Northern Ireland. And I think we have a duty to build a Northern Ireland that is better for the next generation. And I want that to be my legacy and the legacy of my generation, that what we hand on to the next generation is better than the one the Northern Ireland that we inherited. A Northern Ireland that is at peace with itself and a Northern Ireland that is prospering. And so I'm up for the challenge of overcoming the difficulties that we face, because I think that the difficulties we've already overcome are even greater than the ones in front of us.
Do you feel inner conflict between truth and lies, the way of Christianity and the way of the world? If so, it's time to live no lies. With huge spiritual insight, New York Times bestseller John Mark Comer guides us into recognizing and resisting the lies that rob us of peace and freedom. Live No Lies. Yours free when you take out an annual subscription to Premier Christianity magazine. Subscribe at premierchristianity.com.
And with all that in mind, obviously we have Christians across the UK who will be listening to this and perhaps reading your quotes. What would be your one message to them in regards to how they can be praying for Northern Ireland in the coming months and years?
Well, Northern Ireland still has a strong Christian church here. And I would ask people to pray for those of us who come from a faith perspective, who are involved in politics, to pray for Christian politicians and others of a faith perspective, to pray for the churches in Northern Ireland and for the leadership that they need to give, and to pray for the future of Northern Ireland, despite the challenges that we face, to pray for healing and for reconciliation in Northern Ireland, which is really where we need to move to next. In the peace process.
Final question. We're celebrating all that is good about Northern Ireland on Premier Christian Radio this week. And we're hearing from church leaders, individuals, organisations on the ground doing great things. How important is that sense of representing the church in Northern Ireland to the rest of the UK, but also allowing the rest of the UK to learn about some of the good that's coming from the ground?
Well, I desire that Northern Ireland should be a beacon of hope, and that isn't always the case. But I think when one considers the dark years of our troubled past and where we've got to now, I have no doubt that there is a strong Christian influence in all of that. People have prayed. The church has prayed for many years for peace in Northern Ireland. The church has worked towards reconciliation in Northern Ireland. And I think that work is bearing fruit. And at the heart of the Christian gospel is the fruit of the gospel. And I think we see that at work in Northern Ireland. That strong Christian influence is still there. And I think that offers hope from Northern Ireland to other parts of the United Kingdom, that Christian influence can still bring about much good in our society. And if we want to change our society for the better, then I think the Christian church at prayer is a very powerful thing indeed.
That was Premier's Head of News, Marcus Jones, speaking to Sir Geoffrey Donaldson right here on Premier Christian Radio. You're listening to The Profile. We've got another fantastic interview coming up for you in a few moments' time, so don't go anywhere and we'll be right back.
So much is shallow these days. Pictures, but not words. Texts that seem impersonal. Tweets rather than conversation. It can leave us all feeling rather empty. At Premier Christianity, we go deeper to bring you a thought-provoking and credible mix of theological articles, biblical interpretation, interviews, debates, and trends. Premier Christianity, online, in print, in depth. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Good afternoon. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. That's the magazine that sponsors this show and makes it all possible. For our latest subscription offer, head to premierchristianity.com/subscribe to find out how you can get your hands on the UK's leading Christian magazine. But today, here on The Profile, I'm delighted to say my guest this week is Richard Mayhew. He is the CEO of the Nazareth Trust, one of the UK's oldest Christian charities. Nazareth Trust traces its roots back to 1861, when a young Christian doctor made the journey from Edinburgh to Nazareth, the hometown of Jesus, to establish a small four-bed clinic. Today, the charity runs one of the largest acute care and main trauma centres in the Holy Land, and it serves around 300,000 people every year. The Trust has just celebrated its 160th anniversary and says it has an ambitious vision for the future as it seeks to provide healing in the name of Jesus. Well, Richard, who heads up that charity, lives both in Israel and in the UK. He was previously director of the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem and also vice principal of the Anglican International School in Jerusalem. Richard, thank you so much for making the time to be on the show. It's great to be talking to you.
You're welcome. It's good to be here.
So why don't you take us right back to the beginning? We always like to start at the beginning here on The Profile, hear about a person's early life growing up. So did you grow up in the UK, and what was early life like for you?
I was born in Belfast, Northern Ireland, so I'm Northern Irish, although I have since lost my Irish accent. And we moved from Belfast over to England in probably when I was about nine. And then settled in London and moved to Liverpool.
And whereabouts did Christian faith first come into the picture for you?
Well, I was brought up in a Christian household in a Brethren church in Northern Ireland. And as we came over to this country, where I was exposed to more traditions, even evangelical churches, free churches, I always had a faith. All the way through my early years. And I suppose it wasn't until I was at university, I went to Liverpool University, when I really started to look at the claims of Jesus seriously. I needed God in my life, and I knew that, and I wanted more than head knowledge. And I remember I was at my place in Liverpool, and just one evening I decided that I would ask Jesus into my life for real. And since then, I think he's led me on an exciting career, an exciting life. And so I've never regretted that time when I was about 20, 21 in Liverpool.
Do you ever wonder what would have happened had you not made that decision? Do you think life would have taken quite a different path in terms of career, life, family?
I haven't really thought of that, really. I mean, I've always wanted to, I'm a visionary. I like to have a vision, like to have something to go for, something to believe in. And whilst I was searching, I remember I read this book. It was a guy called Len Moles, who was a missionary in Afghanistan. And in the book, he just describes, you know, climbing the mountains and traveling around. And so I was reading this before I was a Christian. I just thought, you know, I like that exciting life. And I suppose for the first time, I realized that you can have an exciting life as a Christian. And if the Lord, you know, can lead you into places which, you know, probably you wouldn't have dreamt of before. So I haven't really thought about what would have liked if I hadn't given my life to the Lord, but certainly I know how the Lord's led me in the last years.
Yeah, you said you wanted that life of adventure, and just a brief glance at your CV would suggest that's exactly what you've ended up with. I mentioned at the beginning of the show, you've had a number of different roles for various Christian organizations. I know you were part of YWAM for a little bit, but more recently in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem. So tell me a little bit about that interest in Israel. Where did that kind of come from for you? Was that a natural part of, well, I'm a Christian, and so of course I'm interested in Israel, or was there a bit of a middle point between those two things where something happened that you came to have an appreciation or a love or an interest in that part of the world?
I hadn't really had a massive interest in Israel, but I spent some little bit of time with YWAM doing a DTS, and at the end of that there was a group of us, about three or four of us, decided that we would go travel, and we decided we'd go to Israel. So that was the first time I'd traveled there. I remember getting the bus from the airport, and I was going to Jerusalem. Jerusalem, you know, climbs up the hills. The bus climbs up the hills towards Jerusalem. I remember as I came into Jerusalem, I just had a real sense of a feeling of, you know, coming home. And that's never really left me. And I just found Jerusalem to be a fascinating place because it's got all these, you know, all the religions there in one place, and even within the religion there are different traditions, and people are all dressed differently, and each person just kind of like they believe, you know, their beliefs are different. And it always challenged me to think, well, what are my beliefs, and what is right and what is wrong? And so I just found the diversity of Jerusalem fascinating. So it was more to do with that. And then I had an opportunity to go to the Anglican International School as a vice principal, and I jumped at the opportunity. I had 4 years in Jerusalem, loved it, loved the traveling around Israel and the West Bank and neighboring countries, and had a real interest in photography. And so again, the diversity of people, I just really enjoyed, you know, taking photographs of faces of people. And each face told a story, and each face told many of them, you know, all the different religions, they're all seeking God. And I just found that, you know, so interesting. And it caused me to obviously look at my own faith and what do I believe in? That's how Jerusalem and Israel really has played an important part of my life.
And I'm right in thinking that you met your wife there as well.
That's right, because on one of my trips, when I was a teacher, I started off as a teacher back in the UK, and in the holidays time, I was obviously single, and I used to, the last day of term, I used to fly off somewhere, and just before term started, I'd fly back, but this particular trip, I flew to Italy, to Rome, where my brother lived, and he said, well, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to make my way across the Mediterranean and by the ferries and through Greece and the like. And he said, oh, if you end up in Jerusalem, go and see some friends of ours. And they lived in the old city. It didn't have an address. So he gave me a postcard. I said, well, this is the picture of the street. So if you can find that street in the old city, go and check some friends out. I ended up in Jerusalem, and I thought, oh, I'll find a street in the old city. So I eventually found the street, and I asked some Palestinian boys, and I said, you know, do you know a Dutch couple who are living there? And they showed me to a house, and I knocked on the door, and I expected to be the friend of my brother's. And I said, you know, are you Harry and Dagmar? But the lady who answered it says, no, I'm Margareta. And that was my wife to be. And she had, the day before, she had flown from Holland to Jerusalem to house sit for these friends of my brother's. So it was quite a fortuitous meeting.
There you go. And looking back, how would you say your faith has changed or developed or matured over time?
I think more patience, obviously running organizations, and each place I've worked, each organization I've run, I've always sought the Lord's will. I asked the Lord, Lord, what do you want me to do with this? And he always gives me a vision for the place, for the organization. And some of the organizations I have ran have been financially challenged. And that's caused me to, I suppose, really walk closely with the Lord in the work. And what I've learned over the years and how it's changed over the years is I probably used to think, you know, expect instant solutions, particularly if you're running organizations, there's a financial challenge or other challenge. But I found that the Lord will answer prayers, but in his time. And I suppose the older I've got, I can be more patient. I can handle crisis a lot easier, although it still can still weigh heavily on your shoulders in terms of the consequences if things go wrong. And yeah, so it's patience, really. Things won't happen overnight. God still works within the natural. But you know, he will provide, he will guide.
Is there ever a tension between the almost the spiritual and the practical, or between the your faith and effectively running a business or a charity, which, yeah, you know, you get into management and complicated finance and HR issues? Is there ever a tension? There's been times where your faith and your job has kind of rubbed up against each other and it's been tricky to figure out?
Yeah, well, no, I think always. I mean, you know, if you're setting a budget, you know, at the beginning of the year, and you know, you're representing a board and you're working for a board, and the board have got the responsibility to set a balanced budget, but where is the room for faith in that? And you know, do you put in your income, you know, a faith line, unknown income, unknown source? What do you do? I don't particularly think that's the right thing to do. However, I do believe that we need to challenge ourselves. And I believe that we've been given, you know, skills and abilities and entrepreneurial spirits, and in order to be able to have a dream and to have a vision, but also we need to work out how we're going to do it. So yes, you know, within money, yes, you're challenged constantly. But there is room for faith. I have found over the years that pretty much most of the budgets I've set have been achieved and sometimes exceeded. Although that's not to say that things haven't gone wrong. They have gone wrong, as everyone would testify as running an organization.
What have been some of those times where it's gone wrong? What are the sort of consequences of that?
Well, I set up social enterprises when I was with an organization, a charitable organization, and it was a great project. The idea really was to set up businesses where we could use the profits of the business to provide supported employment for young people who wouldn't otherwise have the opportunity. And so it is a risk on a business. But the bottom line is the business is a business, and you know, you need to be able to attract customers. They're not going to come to you just because you're a charity. They're going to come to you because you need to provide that you're providing the best value and quality service. So the business that I set up really was it was garages and car repair, of which I knew very little about, but we managed to raise the money for it, and that did very well. And within 2 years, we had bought two more garages and we had a small chain of three. Now, the vision really was to have a chain as big as QuickFit. And you know, and we were doing very well. Within 2-3 years, we had a turnover of over £1 million and doing very well. But we struggled in the end. What started off very well, we struggled. And we struggled basically to get the right number of customers. And also, I learned so much about the car business that it's not all straightforward. Bolts are rusty and they break. And every time one breaks, it costs you money rather than it costs the customer money, and because you've given them a fixed price. And so that business, in the end, we brought in some other expertise, eventually it did not work, and we had to close down. What did I learn from that? I mean, I fully believe that was the right thing to do. And the organization I was working for did go on to do other social enterprises. And so it is now really part of a strategic portfolio. So yes, we went for garages. It was probably, we did make some wrong business decisions. One of which probably I should have brought in the experts quicker than we did. But I was trying to juggle at the time the money that we had available and the costs. And probably I should have brought in experts a little bit quicker. So that was a failed business. But I still believe it was the right thing to do. I think we learned so much. I learned loads from it. I'll never run a garage again, that's for sure. But the principle is right. And there's a lot of social enterprises around now. And this was probably 10, 12, 15 years ago. And social enterprise wasn't really part of the norm. But now there are a lot of very good and large social enterprises providing excellent social outcomes.
So when the pressure is on and when things maybe aren't going so well, how does faith help? What's the difference that faith makes? Or I guess another way of asking the question, I like to ask people, what are your spiritual habits or spiritual disciplines or things that you do that you've built into your life that it's not just about connecting with God, but actually you find when you do those things, it gives you a better perspective, I suppose, on work and life, as well as drawing you closer to God.
At the Nazareth Trust where I am now, COVID started 18 months ago, whatever it is, 2 years ago, that caused us to, enormous problems at the moment, because we're running a hospital, is one of the things that we run, and all the elective surgeries were cancelled, and that's our main source of income. We were looking at probably £10 million deficit for the year. And, but there was a real sense amongst myself and my leadership team that, this is the Lord's will that we are here. And 10 million is just, that's Armageddon to a certain extent. And it would have been, we could never have survived that at all. And, we had a team meeting and I was drawn to this verse. It was, this is the prayer of Jehoshaphat when he was surrounded by a large army. And he just basically said this: Lord, we do not know what to do, but our eyes are upon you. And that's all we could do as a team. How can we turn around £10 million deficit? We just can't. And there was a real strong sense that the Lord's with us. And with COVID, we decided that we would rise up to it. And so we began to we were obviously working with the Ministry of Health in Israel, and we turned several of our wards into COVID wards. And as it turned out, that the financial support that we got from the government and from the Minister of Health more than surpassed the deficit that we were facing at the time. And not only that, we were hugely successful in attracting capital investment money so that we were able to build a brand new ICU. We were able to renovate large parts of the hospital, a lot of the infrastructure, the gases and electrics and all this kind of stuff. So look back in last year's COVID, whilst we were looking at 10 million deficit, it turned out to be the most successful year that we have had. If I, at the beginning of last year, had written down in my wildest dreams, what would I have achieved? What could we achieve? We wouldn't have achieved anything near what we actually did. And so, how do we approach that in that sort of situation? Well, Lord, if you want us to be here, you're going to have to help us out. And there was a real sense, a real holding on to that word. When Jehoshaphat, he was in trouble, And he just held it. He just prayed, Lord, I don't know what to do, but my eyes are upon you. And that's quite often as a leader, as chief exec, that's your prayer.
It's fascinating you mentioned that, because I feel like that's been the prayer of so many Christians throughout the entire pandemic time that we've lived through. A number of people I've spoken to who have quoted that exact same story as you and said, you know, our prayer has been, God, we don't know what to do during COVID, during pandemic, whatever the crisis has been, because it's affected everyone in different ways, of course, but everyone's been praying that prayer, and it seems to have really come through as a script that's been speaking to a lot of people recently. Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit more about Nazareth Trust. I mentioned at the beginning, you've got a really fascinating history dating all the way back to 1861, meaning you've just celebrated your 160th anniversary, which is a very, very long time for any charity to be running. And I suppose you must have especially felt the weight of that in that story you just mentioned, where you described that deficit as feeling like Armageddon. And there must have been a huge amount of pressure on you to think, this charity's been going 160 years, I don't want it to fall on my watch. That must have been a huge pressure. But tell me a bit about the origin story, because it is a really interesting one.
Yeah, and it, you know, we trace it back to 1861, but we probably go back a few years earlier. And our founder of the hospital, it was a four-bed clinic, was a guy called Kalust Vartan. And he was an Armenian Christian from Constantinople, from Istanbul. And he was an interpreter for the British Army during the Crimean War. And it was during the Crimean War, that's when there was a young Florence Nightingale who was tending to the injured British Army soldiers. And she was doing that in Constantinople. And so did Vartan and, you know, Florence Nightingale meet? We don't know. But he left the army at the end of the Crimean War. He left the army and he came to Edinburgh. And he had decided to train as a doctor. And he did his training at the Royal College of Surgeons in Edinburgh, and then practicing at the Cowgate Dispensary in Edinburgh. And he was basically sponsored through the Edinburgh Medical Missionary Society to set up the hospital in Nazareth. He came to Nazareth in 1861 and he set up a small four-bed clinic. It was the only clinic for miles around. I think it was the only one between Beirut in the north and Jerusalem in the south. And that hospital has grown, you know, to what we have today. It didn't, you know, if you look back at management, it didn't go all well for Vartan at all. And it was a real struggle. And, you know, but it did grow. He lost 5 of his 10 children in infancy. And he was married to a Scottish wife, and you can imagine the heartache of that. You would have thought, well, I'm going to pack up and go home. And in fact, 5 of his children, and also him and his wife, Marianne Stewart, are buried in the small cemetery beside today's hospital. But another thing about Vartan is, you know, they had the vision to buy. They were outgrowing the clinics. They'd moved to another property, and I think it was during the First World War. This new hospital, it was confiscated by the Turks. And then eventually, he was in a hospital, it was confiscated by the Turks, but eventually had this vision to buy a piece of land, and which is where the hospital stands today. And it's on a slope, just very close to the center of Nazareth. And they bought that in the 1900s, but he died in 1906, so he died before the buildings were completed, and other doctors came from Scotland to continue that work, and then designed the building that we have today, and obviously that's been extended. So that's how it all started. It started through a lot of heartache and a lot of disappointments, and I always look back on the people over 160 years who have each contributed in their way to the building of this ministry that we have today. We're not just a hospital. We've got 3 other operations. But there are people who have had the privilege of meeting people more recently who have devoted their life to Christian service in Nazareth. And it's incredible. So what I feel myself, and also with my team, is You know, we have inherited a legacy from people from before. And our challenge is, well, what legacy do we give to the next generation of people in Nazareth? And so that's the responsibility that we feel is on our shoulders now.
And just for those who may not be aware of the intricacies of the situation in Israel and the Palestinian territories, can you just explain a little bit about how the conflict affects or doesn't affect your work? What's the setup like? I understand Nazareth is a place where you're likely to meet both Jews and Arabs. You have communities living alongside each other. How does that affect what you're doing?
Yeah, Nazareth is in, people would say, is Israel proper. It's not on the West Bank. And so the people who live in Nazareth would be Israeli citizens. Now, Nazareth is, it's known as the Arab capital of Israel. It's the largest Arab city. And the population that used to be a Christian city, predominantly Christian, but now it is mainly a Muslim city. The Muslim mayor, so it's probably about 60% Muslims and 40% Christian Arabs. And that is in Nazareth. Now, there are very close, there's a place called Nof HaGalil, which is a predominantly Jewish area. So the Nazareth being an Arab town, you know, the hospital itself, it works with and in partnership with the Ministry of Health. And so it's very much integrated within the society within Israel. But Nazareth itself is just a diverse community of Muslims, of Christians. And within the Christians, you have all the different traditions from, you know, the Orthodox and the Catholic to the evangelical Baptists or whatever. So it's a real mix of people. And at the organization, we employ people of all the traditions, of all the nationalities, of all the political persuasions, of all the faiths. So it's a real mix of people.
Sounds like a real melting pot, yeah. Does that create any tensions, or is it, generally speaking, a very, quote-unquote, safe and normal part of the world to live in?
No, I think it's a safe part of the world. We're not really affected by the conflict, which does rise up, particularly, I suppose, in areas like Jerusalem. There's probably a little bit more tension there. There's much less so in Nazareth, although people do have obviously political views, and that can rise to the surface at some point. As the Nazareth Trust, our aim is to be, you know, we may have our own personal political views, but our aim as an organization is not to be part of the politics. We are there predominantly as a healthcare and education provider. To be a Christian organization, a Christian ministry within such a diverse society. That's our goal.
Does that mean if I asked you about your political views, even if you had them, you wouldn't tell me what they were?
I wouldn't tell you what they were, no. Because it's divisive. I mean, I suppose that's one of the reasons why I'm in this job. You know, I've come from Belfast, of which there was, again, you know, two societies which were divided, and I'll have learned to keep my views.
Very good. Now, of course, we have managed to do almost an entire interview without mentioning the dreaded coronavirus, but we can't quite escape it. Because for one thing, Richard, I'm speaking to you at the moment and you're here in the UK, but you are at the time of recording even hoping to get back to Israel, and you'll be more aware than I am of the various travel restrictions and complications that COVID has brought for people like yourself who have been trying to travel throughout the pandemic for business. But tell me, not just for yourself, how you've been affected by COVID, but how has it affected the organization? I mean, especially given that you're working in medical care, you're running hospitals. So how has that affected you?
In many different ways. I mean, we run four areas as the within the Nazareth Trust, but one of which the main part is obviously the hospital. The COVID has just obviously changed, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of we've had to, as the different waves of COVID have come through, we've had to adapt our wards to provide intensive care for COVID patients. And obviously over the last 18 months, we've been hugely pressured for our staff, but they have worked incredibly hard. One of the good things that's come out of it is we've been able to re-establish our pastoral care team, and they have been going in and praying for staff and patients, and they've been going into the, we've got pictures of them all dressed up, you know, booted and suited with you know, protection gear, going into COVID wards to pray for patients. And so whilst it's been difficult, there have been many, you know, blessings as well. But some of the other challenging things for us within the we run a nursing school, the School of Nursing, which trains nurses of the future. And it's the only Arab nursing school in the country. And obviously with COVID, obviously all the lessons went online, and that has become hugely challenging at times. But still, you know, it's been successful. And at the moment, the students are back at college. Two other areas, you know, we run something called the Nazareth Village, which is a, it's on our land, and it's a first century reenactment of the life and times of Jesus, the life and times and teachings of Jesus. And we've built a, you know, a village with a replica synagogue and you know, weaver's house and a potter's house and all that kind of thing. And we have, you know, sheep and goats and you know, olive trees and that sort of thing. And so tourists and pilgrims, not just people from abroad, but also local people, come and they can hear Jesus' teaching in the context of which Jesus gave them. And that's been hugely successful. Now, with COVID, flights stopped. Tourists were barred from entering the country. And so the village has been closed for 18 months. Now, we just opened it recently, because tourists were permitted to return to the country. However, woke up this week, you know, on Sunday, to hear with this new variant that Israel has banned all foreigners again for at least 2 weeks. And so that's going to have hugely challenging times for the Nazareth Village. And we also have an international volunteer program. It's a Christian international volunteer program. People come from all over the world to spend some time with the Nazareth Trust to serve in various capacities, whether it's to help out the hospital or the village or wherever, or other ministries within Nazareth. And again, that's had to close temporarily since the beginning of COVID. That hasn't opened yet. So yeah, it's been hugely encouraging to see what's happened to the hospital and the School of Nursing, but we're also got challenges around two other parts of the organisation.
You mentioned earlier you're a visionary and you're looking to the future. So as we wrap up then, I'd love to hear your kind of, I'm sure you have like a 90-second kind of elevator pitch for what you're seeking to do in the future with all things Nazareth Trust. Do you want to give us a little bit of an insight into what the future vision is, even in these very difficult and trying times, as you mentioned, what we're still coming out of the pandemic?
I'll tell you a story, actually. I was invited to to do some cherry picking up in the north of the north of the country, up near the Lebanese border. And I was just given a basket and I was said, go and help, you know, go and find whatever you want and pick whatever cherries you want. And you had a choice. Do you want the ripe ones near the top of the tree? Do you want the less ripe ones near the bottom? Do you want a different type of cherry? You can go into the orchard next door and take that. That's the vision really for the organization. We want that as people come onto our land in whatever capacity, whether it's to go to the hospital or to the village or whatever, that they would be able to know that we're a Christian organization and they will be able to pick and choose and taste that the Lord is good in whatever capacity that would be. And so our vision for the future really is to reveal our Christian faith and our Christian identity so that people, when they come to us, if they wanted to explore more, they would be able to. But of course, people won't come onto our land. They won't come to us unless we are the best possible organization, unless we have hospital which provides the best possible healthcare. So of course, we are trying to improve our facilities. We're trying to improve our our operations so that people come to us, so that we can, if people want, if we will be able to share our faith with them.
Well, Richard, I've been to Israel many times, but I've not yet come to see what you're doing. So I can promise you when the pandemic is over, when I can get over to Israel, it'll be lovely to meet you in person and see what you're up to. But for now, Richard, thank you so much for speaking to us on The Profile. It's been a pleasure to chat.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm Sam Howes, and you have been listening to The Profile podcast. Really hope you enjoyed that interview. There's loads more where that one came from. Over 200 interviews with different Christians from all walks of life available now on The Profile podcast, and new ones coming each and every week. If you have been enjoying these interviews, we would so appreciate it if you could take just 5 seconds to give us a rating and a review wherever you found this podcast. It helps other people to discover the show. So why not do that now? Give us a rating and a review, and we'll see you next time.